Religion and Science by Bertrand Russell. Produced by Audio Scholar. Your reader is David Case. Religion and Science was first published in 1935, when Bertrand Russell was 63 years old. Remarkably, it represents just the midpoint of Russell's long literary career, which spanned 75 years, until he was 98 years old. Approximately half of the more than 60 books he wrote were written after the publication of Religion and Science. Religion and Science continued an argument which had concerned Russell for most of his life. Russell saw the conflict between religion and science as a conflict between religious authority and scientific observation. Religion claims to embody eternal truths, whereas science starts not from large assumptions, but from particular facts discovered by observation and experiment. He concluded that human welfare is increased by the discovery of scientific truths, and that it is in the interest of the community that such truths should be freely promulgated. To the European intellectual community of the 1930s, threatened by the rise of totalitarianism, the publication of Religion and Science meant the invocation of free thought itself. And now, Religion and Science by Bertrand Russell. First chapter, Grounds of Conflict. Religion and science are two aspects of life, of which the former has been important as far back as we know anything of our human mental history, while the latter, after a fitful, flickering existence among the Greeks and Arabs, suddenly sprang into importance in the 16th century, and has ever since increasingly moulded both the ideas and the institutions among which we live. In what follows, we shall not be concerned with science in general, or with religion in general, but with those points where they have come into conflict in the past, or still do so in the present time. These conflicts have been of two kinds. Sometimes they concern religious assertions refuted by scientific observation, which cause difficulty for those who believe. When these assertions have no inherent religious importance, it is not difficult to explain them away, or to avoid controversy. There is, however, a deeper conflict when science controverts some important dogma or some philosophical doctrine which theologians believe essential to orthodoxy. The disagreements between religion and science were, at first, of the former sort, but gradually became more and more concerned with matters which were considered a vital part of religious teaching. The way in which science arrives at its beliefs is quite different from that of theology. Science starts not from large assumptions, but from particular facts discovered by observation or experiment. From a number of such facts, a general rule is arrived at. This rule is not positively asserted, but is accepted, to begin with, as a working hypothesis. If it is correct, certain hitherto unobserved phenomena will take place in certain circumstances. If it is found that they do take place, that so far confirms the hypothesis. If they do not, the hypothesis must be discarded, and a new one must be invented. However many facts are found to fit the hypothesis, that does not make it certain, although in the end it may come to be thought in a high degree probable. In that case, it is called a theory rather than a hypothesis. A number of different theories, each built directly upon facts, may become the basis for a new and more general hypothesis, from which, if true, they all follow. And to this process of generalization, no limit can be set. Science is always tentative, expecting that modifications in its present theories will sooner or later be found necessary, and aware that its method is one which is logically incapable of arriving at a complete and final demonstration. But in an advanced science, the changes needed are generally only such as serve to give slightly greater accuracy. The old theories remain serviceable where only rough approximations are concerned, but are found to fail when some new minuteness of observation becomes possible. Moreover, the technical inventions suggested by the old theories remain as evidence that they had a kind of practical truth, up to a point. Science thus encourages abandonment of the search for absolute truth and the substitution of what may be called technical truth, which belongs to any theory that can be successfully employed in inventions or in predicting the future. Technical truth is a matter of degree. A theory from which more successful inventions and predictions spring is truer than one which gives rise to fewer. Knowledge ceases to be a mental mirror of the universe and becomes merely a practical tool in the manipulation of matter. But these implications of scientific method were not visible to the pioneers of science, who, though they practiced a new method of pursuing truth, still conceived truth itself as absolutely, as did their theological opponents. The conflict between theology and science was a conflict between authority and observation. Those in science did not ask that propositions should be believed because some important authority had said they were true. On the contrary, they appealed to the evidence of the senses and maintained only such doctrines as they believed to be based upon facts which were patent to all who chose to make the necessary observations. The new method achieved such immense successes, both theoretical and practical, that theology was gradually forced to accommodate itself to science. There is, however, one aspect of religion, and that perhaps the most desirable, which is independent of the discoveries of science, and may survive whatever we may come to believe as to the nature of the universe. Religion has been associated not only with creeds and churches, but with the personal life of those who felt its importance. In the best of the saints and mystics, there existed in combination the belief in certain dogmas and a certain way of feeling about the purposes of human life. The person who feels deeply the problems of human destiny, the desire to diminish the sufferings of humanity, and the hope that the future will realize the best possibilities of our species, is nowadays often said to have a religious outlook, however little he may accept of traditional religion. Insofar as religion consists in a way of feeling, rather than in a set of beliefs, science cannot touch it. Perhaps the decay of dogma may, psychologically, make such a way of feeling temporarily difficult, because it has been so intimately associated with theological belief. But this difficulty need not endure. In fact, many free thinkers have shown in their lives that this way of feeling has no essential connection with a creed. No real excellence can be inextricably bound up with unfounded beliefs. And if theological beliefs are unfounded, they cannot be necessary for the preservation of what is good in religious outlook. To think otherwise is to be filled with fears as to what we may discover, which will interfere with our attempts to understand the world. But it is only in the measure in which we achieve such understanding that true wisdom becomes possible. The Copernican Revolution. The first pitched battle between theology and science, and in some ways the most notable, was the astronomical dispute as to whether the Earth or the Sun was the center of what we now call the solar system. The orthodox theory was the Ptolemaic, according to which the Earth is at rest in the center of the universe, while the Sun, Moon, planets, and system of fixed stars revolve round it, each in its own sphere. According to the new theory, the Copernican, the Earth, so far from being at rest, has a twofold motion. It rotates on its axis once a day, and it revolves round the Sun once a year. The theory which we call Copernican, although it appeared with all the force of novelty in the 16th century, had in fact been invented by the Greeks, whose competence in astronomy was very great. Copernicus, who was born in 1473 and died in 1543, has the honour, perhaps scarcely deserved, of giving his name to the Copernican system. After studying at the University of Krakow, he went to Italy as a young man, and by the year 1500 he had become a mathematics professor in Rome. 3 years later, however, he returned to Poland, where he was employed in reforming the currency and combating the Teutonic Knights. His spare time, during the 23 years from 1507 to 1530, was spent in composing his great work, On the Revolutions of the Heavenly Bodies, which was published in 1543, just before his death. As it was, he long delayed publication because he feared ecclesiastical censure. Himself an ecclesiastic, he dedicated his book to the Pope, and his publisher added a preface, which may perhaps have been not sanctioned by Copernicus, saying that the theory of the Earth's motion was put forward solely as a hypothesis and was not asserted as positive truth. For a long time, these tactics sufficed, and it was only Galileo's bolder defiance that brought retrospective official condemnation upon Copernicus. Now, there is nothing in the Copernican astronomy to prove that we are less important than we naturally suppose ourselves to be, but the dethronement of our planet from its central position suggests to the imagination a similar dethronement of its inhabitants. While it was thought that the sun and moon, the planets and the fixed stars, revolved once a day about the earth, it was easy to suppose that they existed for our benefit, and that we were of special interest to the Creator. But when Copernicus and his successors persuaded the world that it is we who rotate, while the stars take no notice of the earth, when it appeared further that our earth is small compared to several of the planets, and that they are small compared to the sun, when calculations and the telescope revealed the vastness of the solar system, of our galaxy, and finally of the universe of innumerable galaxies, it became increasingly difficult to believe that such a remote and parochial retreat could have the importance to be expected of the home of human beings, if humans had the cosmic significance assigned to them in traditional theology. Mere considerations of scale suggested that perhaps we were not the purpose of the universe. Lingering self-esteem whispered that if we were not the purpose of the universe, it probably had no purpose at all. The next great step in astronomy was taken by Kepler, who was born in 1571 and died in 1630. Who, though his opinions were the same as Galileo's, never came into conflict with the Church. The first two of Kepler's three laws were published in 1609, the third in 1619. The most important of the three, from the point of view of our general picture of the solar system, was the first, which stated that the planets revolve around the sun in ellipses of which the sun occupies one focus. Kepler's laws, unlike the law of gravitation, were purely descriptive. They did not suggest any general cause of the movements of the planets, but gave the simplest formulae by which to sum up the results of observation. Simplicity of description was, so far, the only advantage of the theory that the planets revolved about the sun rather than the earth, and that the apparent diurnal revolution of the heavens was really due to the earth's rotation. Galileo, who was born in 1564 and died in 1642, was the most notable scientific figure of his time, both on account of his discoveries and through his conflict with the Inquisition. His father was an impoverished mathematician and did his utmost to turn the boy towards what he hoped would prove more lucrative studies. He successfully prevented Galileo from studying mathematics until, at the age of 19, he happened, as an eavesdropper, to overhear a lecture of geometry. He seized with avidity upon the subject, which had for him all the charm of forbidden fruit. The great merit of Galileo was the combination of experimental mechanical skill with the power of embodying his results in mathematical formulae. Galileo discovered that, apart from the resistance of air, when bodies fall freely, they fall with a uniform acceleration, which in a vacuum is the same for all, no matter what their bulk or the material of which they are composed. Throughout the 2,000 years from Aristotle to Galileo, no one had thought of finding out whether the laws of falling bodies are of what Aristotle says they are. To test such statements may seem natural to us, but in Galileo's day it required genius. Experiments on falling bodies, though they might vex pedants, could not be condemned by the Inquisition. It was the telescope that led Galileo onto more dangerous ground. Hearing that a Dutchman had invented such an instrument, Galileo reinvented it, and almost immediately discovered many new astronomical facts, the most important of which, for him, was the existence of Jupiter's satellites. They were important as a miniature copy of the solar system, according to the theory of Copernicus. Besides Jupiter's moons, the telescope revealed other things horrifying to theologians. It showed that Venus has phases like the moon. Copernicus had recognized that his theory demanded this, and Galileo's instrument transformed an argument against him into an argument in his favor. The moon was found to have mountains, which for some reason was thought shocking. More dreadful still, the sun had spots. This was considered as tending to show that the Creator's work had blemishes. Teachers in Catholic universities were therefore forbidden to mention sunspots, and in some of them, this prohibition endured for centuries. Galileo was ordered by the Pope to appear before the Inquisition, which commanded him to abjure his errors, which he did. He solemnly promised that he would no longer hold the Copernican opinion, or teach it, whether in writing or by word of mouth. It must be remembered that it was only 16 years since the burning of Giordano Bruno for similar offences. At the insistence of the Pope, all books teaching that the earth moves were therefore placed upon the index, and now, for the first time, the work of Copernicus himself was condemned. Galileo, however, was of an optimistic temperament, and at all times prone to direct his wit against fools. He set to work to write his Dialogues on the Two Greatest Systems of the World, which were completed in 1630 and published in 1632. But while the scientific world applauded, the ecclesiastics were furious. Galileo was once more summoned to Rome to appear before the Inquisition, which, feeling itself flouted, was in a sterner mood than in 1616. At first he pleaded that he was too ill to endure the journey from Florence. Thereupon the Pope threatened to send his own physician to examine the culprit, who should be brought in chains if his illness proved not to be desperate. This induced Galileo to undertake the journey without waiting for the verdict of his enemy's medical emissary. When he reached Rome, he was thrown into the prisons of the Inquisition and threatened with torture if he did not recant. Galileo, accordingly, publicly and on his knees, recited a long formula drawn up by the Inquisition. Satisfied that the interests of religion and morals had been served by causing the greatest man of the age to commit perjury, the Inquisition allowed him to spend the rest of his days in retirement and silence. Not in prison, it is true, but controlled in all his movements and forbidden to see his family or friends. He became blind in 1637 and died in 1642, the year in which Newton was born. The Church forbade the teaching of the Copernican system as true in all learned and educational institutions that it could control. Works teaching that the earth moves remained banned till 1835. Although the theologians, after their disastrous victory over Galileo, found it prudent to avoid such official definiteness as they had shown in that instance, they continued to oppose science as far as they dared. Demonology and medicine. The scientific study of the human body and its diseases has had to contend, and to some extent still has to contend, with a mass of superstition, supported until modern times by the whole weight of ecclesiastical authority. Disease was sometimes a divine visitation in punishment of sin, but more often the work of demons. It could be cured by the intervention of saints, either in person or through their holy relics, by prayer and pilgrimages, or, when due to demons, by exorcism and by treatment which the demons and the patient found disgusting. We now know that certain kinds of diseases can be cured by faith, while others cannot. No doubt miracles of healing do occur, but in an unscientific atmosphere, legends soon magnify the truth and obliterate the distinction between the hysterical diseases which can be cured in this way and the others which demand a treatment based upon pathology. Plagues and pestilences, which were common and terrible in the Middle Ages, were attributed sometimes to demons, sometimes to the wrath of God. A method of averting God's anger, which was much recommended by the clergy, was the gift of lands to the church. In 1680, when the plague raged at Rome, it was ascertained that this was due to the anger of Saint Sebastian, who had been duly neglected. A monument was raised to him, and the plague ceased. The Black Death in 1348 caused outbreaks of superstition of various sorts in various places. One of the favorite methods of appeasing God's anger was the destruction of Jews. In Bavaria, 12,000 are reckoned to have been killed. In Strasbourg, 2,000 were burnt. And so on. Not only were superstitious methods of combating disease universally believed to be effective, but the scientific study of medicine was severely discouraged. Anatomy was considered wicked, both because it might interfere with the resurrection of the body, and because the church abhorred the shedding of blood. Dissection was virtually forbidden. Pope Pius V, in the latter half of the 16th century, renewed earlier decrees by ordering physicians first to call in the priest, on the ground that bodily infirmity frequently arises from sin, and to refuse further treatment if the patient did not confess to the priest within 3 days. Perhaps he was wise in view of the backward condition of medicine in those days. Theological prejudices reappear when awakened by any startling novelty. Inoculation against smallpox aroused a storm of protest from the church. Many Scottish ministers joined in a manifesto saying the inoculation was endeavouring to baffle a divine judgment. So late as 1885, when there was a severe outbreak of smallpox in Montreal, the Catholic part of the population resisted vaccination, with the support of their clergy. However, the effect in diminishing the death rate from smallpox was so notable that theological terrors have failed to outweigh fear of the disease. The treatment of mental disorders, as may be imagined, was peculiarly superstitious, and remained so longer than any other branch of medicine. Insanity was regarded as due to diabolical possession. Sometimes a cure could be effected by exorcism, or by touching a relic, or by a holy person's command to the demon to come forth. Sometimes elements which savour of magic were mixed with religion. It came to be thought that the best way to drive out the evil spirit was to torture it, or to humiliate its pride, since pride was the source of Satan's fall. Foul odours were used, and disgusting substances. The formula of exorcism became longer and longer, more and more filled with obscenities. By such means, the Jesuits of Vienna, in 1583, cast out 12,652 devils. When, however, such mild methods failed, the patient was scourged. If the demon still refused to leave him, he was tortured. For centuries, innumerable helpless lunatics were thus given over to the cruelty of their barbarous jailers. Even when the superstitious beliefs by which cruelty had originally been inspired were no longer accepted, the tradition survived that the insane should be treated harshly. The harm that theology has done is not to create cruel impulses, but to give them the sanction of what professes to be a lofty ethic, and to confer an apparently sacred character upon practices which have come down from more ignorant and barbarous ages. The intervention of theology in medical questions is not yet at an end. Opinions on such subjects as birth control and the legal permission of abortion are still influenced by biblical texts and ecclesiastical decrees. See, for instance, the encyclical on marriage issued a few years ago by the Pope. Those who practice birth control, he says, sin against nature and commit a deed which is shameful and intrinsically vicious. As regards the interruption of pregnancy for medical reasons, that is, when it is considered necessary in order to save the woman's life, he states, "What could ever be a sufficient reason for excusing in any way the direct murder of the innocent? Thou shalt not kill." It is difficult to resist the conclusion that, to many men, there is something enjoyable in the sufferings of women, and that therefore there is a propensity in men to cling to any theological or ethical code, which makes it a woman's duty to suffer. Although, as we have just seen, theology still tries to interfere in medicine, over most of the field the battle for the scientific independence of medicine has been won. No one now thinks it impious to avoid pestilences and epidemics by sanitation and hygiene. And though some still maintain that diseases are sent by God, they do not argue that it is therefore impious to try to avoid them. The consequent improvement in health and increase of longevity is one of the most remarkable and admirable characteristics of our age. Even if science had done nothing else for human happiness, it would deserve our gratitude on this account. Evolution. The sciences have developed in an order the reverse of what might have been expected. What was most remote from ourselves was first brought under the domain of law, and then gradually what was nearer. First the heavens, next the earth, then animal and vegetable life, then the human body, and last of all, as yet very imperfectly, the human mind. In this there is nothing inexplicable. Familiarity with detail makes it difficult to see broad patterns. The outlines of roads are more easily traced from an aeroplane than from the ground. A person's friends know what he is likely to do better than he does himself. At a certain turn in the conversation, they foresee the dreadful inevitability of one of his favorite anecdotes, whereas to himself he seems to be acting on a spontaneous impulse, by no means subject to law. The detailed acquaintance derived from intimate experience is not the easiest source for the generalized kind of knowledge which science seeks. Not only the discovery of simple natural laws, but also the doctrine of the gradual development of the world as we know it, began in astronomy. But the latter, unlike the former, found its most notable application in connection with the growth of life on our planet. The doctrine of evolution, which we are now to consider, though it began in astronomy, was of more scientific importance in geology and biology, where, also, it had to contend with more obstinate theological prejudices than were brought to bear against astronomy after the victory of the Copernican system. It is difficult for a modern mind to realize how recent is the belief in development and gradual growth. It is, in fact, almost wholly subsequent to Newton. The doctrine of the gradual evolution of plants and animals by descent and variation, which came into biology largely through geology, may be divided into three parts. There is first the fact, as certain as a fact about remote ages can hope to be, that the simpler forms of life are the older, and that those with a more complicated structure make their first appearance at a later stage of the record. Second, there is the theory that the later and more highly organized forms did not arise spontaneously, but grew out of the earlier forms through a series of modifications. This is what is meant by evolution. Third, there is the study, as yet far from complete, of the mechanism of evolution, that is, of the causes of variation and of the survival of certain types at the expense of others. The general doctrine of evolution is now universally accepted among biologists, though there are still doubts as to its mechanism. The chief historical importance of Darwin lies in his having suggested a mechanism, natural selection, which made evolution seem more probable. But his suggestion, while still accepted as valid, is less completely satisfying to modern science than it was to his immediate successors. Darwin's theory was essentially an extension to the animal and vegetable worlds of laissez-faire economics. All living things reproduce themselves so fast that the greater part of each generation must die without having reached the age to leave descendants. A female codfish lays about 9 million eggs a year. Even human populations, though their rate of natural increase is slower than that of any other animals except elephants, have been known to double in 25 years. If this rate continued throughout the world for the next 2 centuries, the resulting population would amount to 500 billion. But we find, in fact, that animal and plant populations are, as a rule, roughly stationary. And the same has been true of human populations at most periods. There is, therefore, both within each species and as between different species, a constant competition, in which the penalty of defeat is death. It follows that if some members of a species differ from others in any way which gives them an advantage, they are more likely to survive. If the difference has been acquired by learning, it will not be transmitted to their descendants. But if it is congenital, it is likely to reappear in at least a fair proportion of their posterity.